Welcome to the On Coaching Podcast. I'm Steve Magnus, joined as always by my good friend and colleague, John Marcus. John, what's going on, my man?
Steve, you know why we're here. We're here to give the people what they want.
That is right. And you know what? Today, we're kind of going back. We're going back to the classic. The classic. The OG, the thing that got me, kind of put me on the map.
The book you need in your life, if you don't have it in your life, get it right now. We're trying to sell the original book, the cult classic, Underground.
That's right.
That is The Science of Running by Stephen Magnus.
But before we get to it, you know what? The Science of Running is a great book. You know, one day I'll tell the story of how it came to fruition in depth.
I just imagine like you just like speed typing, like on as much Adderall. Like, I'm not sleeping, I'm just typing. that's what my.
I'll just put it this way. It only could be done when you're in your early mid-20s. Yes. And single, there's no other way that gets done. So I'm just going to put that out there.
Yeah, a lot of Chinese takeout, like you just did not leave the house or the laptop for, weeks.
Yeah, just crushing. So, but before we get there, you know what? As I said, I love The Science of Running, but do you know how you stay updated on it?
How do you stay updated, Stephen? Tell me.
You join the Scholar Program because... Yes, The Science of Running provides a foundation, but everything in the, 8 years, 9 years since it came out that we've updated, John and I have gone back and forth on, that we've said, hey, this needs amends, we've thrown it into the Scholar Program, and we've discussed it in the Scholar Clubhouse, and slice and dice it apart and say, oh, you know what, we should have updated this or expanded on this. Like, all of it is in there. That's where it is. That's where the updated, you know, version 2 of 3, 4, 5 of Science of Running is this continual evolution in our Scholar Program.
It's basically the living organism, right? It's like when a new study comes out or a new, like, you know, meta-analysis or a new review, like Brooks's like lactate, you know, meta-review analysis that came out that we did a podcast on, like scholars got it first, and we like went through and like chopped it up piecemeal and said, hey, we got to focus on this. We got to look at this. Like, this has a really big impact. That's the place to get it. And you know what? I'm going to use peer pressure. All the cool kids are joining. Like, we're almost at 450 members now. It is just cascading. New people sign up every day. The cool thing about it is you can just ask questions and people are ready to give you recommendations and responses. I'll give you an example. I always struggle with vitamin D in Oregon in the winter, especially now we're in La Nina, but I always struggle with a supplement, finding one, you know, to supplement my low levels in addition to my high nutritional intake, spinach, milk, salmon, all the good stuff, egg yolks. It's just never enough, especially when you have La Nina. Steve doesn't have that trouble anymore in sunny Houston. I still do. So I was like, hey, can someone recommend to me a good bioavailability vitamin D supplement that they've take that's safe and effective, you know, and just as a catch-all to kind of get, crowdsource people's different recommendations to help my own kind of decision-making process about which one to actually hone in onto. And it was a robust discussion, several scholars coming in, you know, saying, hey, just do nutrition, or hey, look at these, or hey, you know, maybe, you know, these supplements are the ones I take, you know, not selling anything. We're not Alex Jones here. We're not Mehmet Oz. But it was just a good crowdsource with people who are kind of up to speed on it. And it was like, all right, this is a lot of easy intel. And you know what? I just punched it in the computer, sent it off. And like in 3 hours, I found the one I wanted, and I, you know, with for my needs. And it was awesome. And I have scholars to thank for it. So that's the beauty of it. Or high school coaches with questions about what should I include in dynamic warm-up or this or that. And it's just basically, it's like the question you'd ask your colleagues at a coaching clinic or conference in the side time between speakers, or, you know, at lunch or coffee or the pub, say, hey, how should I do this? Because that's honestly, right, the reality of how we work as human beings is, yeah, there's a lot of official literature and evidence and all that stuff that should be understood. and digested. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we ask people we know what they're doing and then take that recommendation to heart.
Bingo. I mean, that's the beauty of it. You got so many people with expertise. Why not take advantage of that and share and grow and all that good stuff? So,
yeah. I mean, if you're interested in like a lactate testing, we got a lot of people at all levels, you know, masters to elite of elite who are like using lactate testing. And it's not just Steve or I, but they're like, here's how you use it. Amazing resource.
Yes. All right. So sign up. Join the community, you know, get on board, all that good stuff. And today, so today, John, we're going to dive into general versus specific training. What is that?
Yeah, what is it? This one is tough because it's specific training is specific and general training is general. And, you know, it seems very simple and cliche to say that, but we are, you know, still confused on in almost every sport about it. I mean, our good friends over at Hammer Media, you know, Vern Gambetta, Martin Basner, Nick Garcia talk about this all the time ad nauseum. And yet we still like to think that our general training has more impact in our performance than it really does. So we spend a lot of time doing general work versus understanding actually training needs to be specific, right? It's the SED principle, you know, specific adaptations to impose demand. So that's the key.
All right. So, you know, and I think it was Canova who said, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but the goal is essentially to over time be able to handle more and more of the specific work to be able to be done. Yeah. And what it has, and I think this is an important distinction, and this is why we're going to go through this, is that people hear that and they say, oh, I just need to do specific. But everything around it supports and builds the foundation so that you can handle higher and higher stimuluses of it. Okay. So the way I like to think of it is it's like having a pipe, right? And it's a long meandering pipe and we can see where the water comes out, right? And we might say, oh, I'm just going to build a bigger, you know, water spout or get a better, you know, end of the hose or nozzle to be better. And if we only focus on that, then what happens is often the kink in the pipe, the slowdown is somewhere earlier. So what we have to do is make sure as we are developing from general to specific, make sure we are, you know, taking care of the kinks of the pipe so that our as the water comes out of the hot nozzle, like we can build and build that more because we've got the pressure behind it to go. So it's all, the point is it's all complementary. And the goal of that general or support work is to connect, almost like building a scaffolding or ladder that allows us to do more specific work or have that specific work give us a higher bang for our buck and actually, you know, actually function. And, you know, before I turn it back over to you, John, we talked about this a little in our episode on VO2 max in the sense that if VO2 max is, let's say, 3K pace and you're running a 3K specific. If you just jump straight to the specific work, the VO2 max work, like you get pretty fast, pretty quick. But if you've taken care of all the kinks in the pipe, then that, and then you add in that VO2 max work, that VO2 max work is going to have a much bigger effect and be sustainable than if you just jump straight to it. So the point is, when we look at these classification systems, is I want you to think of it as like interleaved, interlaced, where everything supports one another. And you're trying to build, you know, the structure so that you can handle, amplify, take advantage of that specific work versus, you know, just jumping straight there.
I'm going to go cherry pick and Steve. I'm going to go page 172 of The Science of Running. First edition. and to the topic or the section called General to Specific, a classification system that rests in the chapter, what are we trying to accomplish with training? So to quote a younger Steve Magnus, there's an endless number of ways workouts can be done, and it's a complex task that needs to be simplified. So the majority of workout classification systems work off creating zones based on physiological parameters like VO2 max, lactate threshold, easy, you know, fat max, etc. The problem with such a system is it works off the premise that these zones are the only or optimal way to enhance these parameters, which we know is false. So when we talk about general specific, if we're going to throw out the physiological framework, what are we going to do? So in a scientific approach to marathon training, Renato Canova, 1999, anchored his classification system in what Steve quoted as a system used in Europe for over 30 years and is common in sprint and power events for classification. Now, I put a pin in this, and it's called sports form development. Actually, it was created by Anatoly Bondarchuk, and we're doing a channel in the Scholar Clubhouse right now about it. And it's essentially, I just went a lot deeper on this one line Steve said. And I was like, wait a second, you glossed over the best part. But back on track to quoting the book. So the advantage of such a system is that it focuses on what matters, running speed. Running speed matters. If you've ever heard Canova and his mathematics, I like to call him Canova math, we're going to talk about, okay, we're going to run 105% of race pace. Okay, we're going to run 90% of race pace. Okay, we're going to run 116% of race pace. That's how he's anchoring these intensities and these speeds for his athletes to run, is because he's anchored his classification system in running speed or studying the pace. Instead of using these physiological parameters, it focuses on how closely the workout or run you are doing replicates the desired race. Why does this matter? Because of the law of training specificity. So if it's not specific, you're not getting closer and closer to your output, right? The ultimate goal of training is to race a particular distance at a certain pace. The goal of race pace and distance are specific training. According to the law of specificity, this is what matters most. So this makes sense from a physiological perspective too, as running at race pace is the only way to mimic the exact muscle fiber recruitment pattern and fatiguing byproducts that will build up that occur in a race. So does this mean should we always just train only at race pace? Absolutely not. And this is what Steve was trying to communicate. Other paces and intensities are needed to elicit adaptation and support the specific training. Specific training can be defined as your goal race pace plus or minus a few percents, and simply serves as the basis from which to start and orient your classification system. So for in the science of running, Steve goes on to use 5Ks as the goal race pace and then gives examples of that. However, there's an important thing to put a pin in as well. First, there are no magical training zones that can maximize adaptation or dead space where the adaptation is less. The body responds to demand if it's placed under, it is placed under. Thus, every training pace will impact a slightly different stimulus. That's important to know. And as Steve was just saying, every pace is connected. We tend to think of them as in isolation. Instead of having abrupt training zones, whether it's based on physiologic zones or race pace, there is a large degree of interaction between every intensity. And it's really important to note this because even Anatoly Bondarchuk, with his classification scheme, which is a little simpler than what Canova created and will present today, he'll even say, you know, it's kind of squishy, right? It's kind of like, yeah, that's a special or a specific development exercise, but it also has some competitive exercise qualities and also has some special or specific preparatory qualities. So we tend to think it's like really hard and fast, but it's more better thought as a spectrum. And then when you step back, you have to say, where are you spending in the majority of your time on the spectrum? And a lot of times what we think is specific training is actually very general training based off of what Steve and I, or what Steve just talked about in the science of running, is the running speed and muscle fiber recruitment. If it's slow, it might not be actually having as big of a transfer in training as we had hoped or think.
You know, one of these days, we're just going to read the science of running for the entire podcast.
We should just do that.
just read it. It'll be our audio version of it. So I thanks for highlighting that, John, because I think there's a couple key points to pull out here that are really important that you highlighted as well, is that, A, there's no zones. Like, we like zones, but zones are just a classification system, and we have to draw, it's almost like we have to draw a barrier somewhere between the zones. So mm-hmm. we kind of like, you know, justify around physiology yeah. when oftentimes there's no, you know, there is no abrupt thing. Even the things we call thresholds are like nuanced and gradual and kind of a spectrum versus like a hard, you're below and you're above, you know, in mm-hmm. this instance. And anyone who's done lactate testing can kind of tell you that, because it's kind of all over the place sometimes.
No, it's definitely not cut and dry, right? It's not like, oh, everyone's at 4 millimoles for their like lactate term point. Like,
yep.
Nope.
Exactly. And then the other part of it is I think important that, you know, we kind of mentioned there is that, that all of the training paces are connected, and that specificity is tied to pace, but really it's about kind of the you know, what's going on underneath, on the, like I talked about in the book, on like muscle fiber recruitment patterns and all that good stuff that occurs. And the reason I bring this up is because often, you know, I'll use the example. Often we think like, oh, you know, I'm going to do hill repeats at X pace, and we put them in this bucket. But hill repeats change the muscle fiber recruitment significantly, so that I often think of them as more non-specific and support or general, which we'll go through. And I'd argue Canova does the same when he looks at things like his hill sprints or his hill circuits, especially the hill circuits, which he kind of, you know, classifies as a non-specific way to develop some strength endurance. So I think it's, again, something that's really important, some nuance there that is worth highlighting.
Oh, it's huge. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up, because I have changed how in the years I think about hill repeats as well, based off of this, and also based off of Franz Bosch's work that demonstrates when you're running hills, the hamstring activation is not there. It's not the same. So we run hills as a quote unquote speed thing, but it's a way to save weak hamstrings or actually neglect them, because they're not as recruited as heavily when you're going uphill. And then you get on the flat track and then you pull a hamstring. You're like, oh, speed work, it hurts us. And it's like, no, we haven't developed the synergistic harmonization and the coordination of the hamstring and the gait cycle, because all we're doing are these hill repeats. Why? Well, because Mike Smith does them and NAU is good. That's not a good enough explanation, right? Like, you got to understand why, say, a program is employing them, what the, you know, when they're employing them and how they're employing them, rather than just that copy and paste. Now, there's a really interesting review from 2021 that just came out from Plockton and colleagues, Daniel Plockton and colleagues, called Muscle Fiber Type Transitions with Exercise Training Shifting Perspectives. And in this, they talk about how muscle fiber types can not only just be type 1, the slow twitch, or type 2X, the pure, what we call anaerobic fast twitch, and not only transition to type 2A, right, that kind of hybrid oxidized fast twitch, but actually a muscle tissue can be a hybrid of type 1 and type 2A at the same time. So think about it like this. We tend to think, oh, this is a fast twitch kid or a slow twitch kid or athlete. But the reality is, with training, we can actually influence if a muscle fiber can be at the same time type 1 and type 2A, which is huge, because you get the glycolytic storage capacity of type 2 fibers, but then you can also get the oxidative aerobic energy resynthesis of ATP of type 1 in the same fiber. What? I'm sorry, my mind blown. I mean, holy crap, dude.
Welcome to the wonders and joys of physiology.
Exactly. It's not as cut and dry, right? And that's what Steve means as a spectrum.
It is. And you know, one of my favorite, I remember this from grad school, one of my favorite studies is they were, you know, everyone talks about fiber type transitions. We'll go on this tangent. And often if you work in the sprint world, they're like fearful of doing any sort of like slower stuff because of fiber type transitions going from those kind of pure fast twitch anaerobic that you said to kind of that more mixed. But if you look at the data, and I remember this hit home, grad school professor of physiology professors talking, and he says, if you look at the data, even doing just sprints or just pure, like, you know, heavy lifting, your fibers will switch or transition more towards that kind of mixed middle, because any sort of training stimulus kind of takes us away, because any training stimulus has some volume and some damage associated, which will move us more to, you know, some variant in the middle. And I love that, because what it tells you is we often have these simple paradigms of like, oh, you're either fast twitch or slow twitch. And like, watch out if you're fast twitch and we don't want to transition at whatsoever. But even if all we did was do, you know, 40 meter sprints, we would transition some of our fibers from pure fast twitch to more of the kind of murky, you know, hybrid in the middle. And I think that's such a wonderful analogy to kind of like what we're doing in the rest of training, which is we like to have it cut and dry and classified and zones do this. And if you do this zone, it impacts that. But it doesn't work that way. And in fact, there was another study, I forget the author because I just glanced at it the other day, that compared different interval types. So different interval types where they're looking at, you know, fat, like your classic 300s and 400s at, you know, mile or 800 pace, or you're looking at 600s or 800s. It basically classified them by distance to kind of have some classification. And they found that all the interval types improved. This was in cyclists, all improved the performance to about the same degree. But if you looked in at, you know, the specifics of what was going on, they did so through a slightly different manner. So sometimes you got more what we call central components. So think like heart, you know, central cardiovascular. And then some were more peripheral in terms of like what's going on in the muscles and, you know, all that good enzymatic level and all that good stuff. Even though they kind of felt some, you know, they fell in the roughly the same classification of like, you know, these are, you know, pretty fast intervals at between 400 and 800 meters in length. And I love that again, because it shows the nuance of that adaptation that occurs. And, you know, that's why I think getting back to this classification system, we need a classification system that may not be perfect, but isn't grounded in what we're most concerned with or most resonate with as runners, which is around, you know, around the pace that we're going to try and race at, and have that be the foundational component that holds it together. And then we branch off from there. And the reason this is important is because, so here's how I like to think about it, John, is in a traditional zone model, you know, let's say you have five zones. If you do whatever zone three and it's threshold tempo type stuff, that zone is the same whether you're training for the 800 or training for the marathon, right? Everyone's like, oh, zone three does this. But when you center it like Canova or Bondarchuk or I did in the Science of Running around the race pace, that threshold work has a different impact depending on what you're trying to accomplish. So to give you the example, if I'm training for, you know, the 10K or the 5K, that threshold kind of serves as like, oh, it's high-end aerobic support. It kind of builds a little of that foundation, right? If I'm training for the half marathon, that threshold is literally my specific training.
Yes. Yes, it is. Right?
It is literally the specific training where it's like, you know, this isn't aerobic support. This isn't like, oh, giving me, this is working on that end of the nozzle being like, this is our bread and butter. We got to get efficient here, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that that nuance there of shifting that emphasis changes where it is, because think of it like this, okay? In the traditional zone model, you'd be like, oh, threshold work, it comes, you know, in the pre-computation phase where we're you know, building this, you know, for whatever have you. But if you center it around the pace that is specific, if I'm training for a half marathon, when do I want the bread and butter of my threshold / specific half marathon stuff to be? In the last, you know, it's in the last 6 weeks or whatever it is where I'm building towards that race, right? It's not early in the season. Like maybe if I'm a high school kid training for a 5K, I might do more threshold stuff at the end of the summer building into racing season. No, if I'm training for a half marathon, it is, you know, specific going into that race. And I think that is why the classification system based around what is quote unquote specific to the demands that we're facing is really freaking important and shifts how we see training compared to the traditional kind of zone model.
Yeah. It's what ends up happening, right, is if we just take this pure physiological approach, we get all these like calculations of paces and everything. I'm like, all right, we're doing VO2 max training and, you know, this is the pace for VO2 max or this. And it's like, but I always ask coaches who make that calculation, who anchor it, say, on the VO2 max, which is definitely one route you can take to anchor, you know, your training paradigm. Have you tested your high school athlete's VO2 max? I'm like, well, no. Well, how do you know what it is? Oh, well, you know, we ballpark it. I go, yeah, but it's not. Actually, your calculation is probably wildly off, because if you aren't measuring the specific thing, how do you know you're getting better at the specific thing if that's what it is, VO2 max? The reason I like this is because the specific thing is running speed. You measure it. It's easy to measure. You can measure it every day. And like one of the cornerstones of Bonnerchuk's methodology when he's working at throwers in the sports form development classification system is test every day. And what they would literally do is just throw the hammer, because he was, you know, the world's greatest coach and his discipline was a hammer throw. So they just throw the hammer and just measure how far it went every day. And it's just, as long as you had a trend that was in line with their, what they call athlete types or athlete profiles, and your specific one, your individual one, as long as your trend of how you were progressing, and sometimes there'd be like, you know, ups and downs and bumps and wiggles, was in the general predictable direction, that means the experiment of the current training complex of exercises was working. But if we're saying VO2 max is the thing or lactate's the thing, and you're not testing that every day, you don't know. Versus you can test pace every day, you just click the watch. I mean, super simple. And so what ends up happening, right, is we end up creating a mishmash of training in a training week, because we just go with like, oh, hard, easy, that's the way to do it. And, you know, just a little bit of everything. And that is not a bad way to go about training anyone who has, who's a beginner or the clean slate phenomena, right? Who's just new, brand new to all the stimuli. For sure, a variety of stimuli will create improvement in performance. What we're talking about though is when we start to get a little bit more older with a higher training age behind us, 2, 3, 4, 5 years of a training age, we do need to dial up the specificity, because the body will max out, so to speak, or hit a ceiling in general work because of the law of accommodation. And actually it's very interesting. Like you look at things like in side topic here, like even a mitochondrial plasticity, it is super plastic, meaning it responds immediately to load and it also responds immediately to no load. And it's pretty quick, the fusion and fission of mitochondria and different muscle fiber types and cells. It's so cool that we're learning all this new stuff about it that, you know, even 10 years ago we were ignorant to. But it makes sense. Like it's our body, we as humans are scavengers. Like we scavenged, hunt and gathered, ate and did things, and we are like the best decathletes on the planet as an evolutionary species, basically. Not really great at any one thing, but pretty good at a lot of things. And so it makes sense that your mitochondria and also your muscle fiber types can actually transition really rapidly with exposure to a certain demand, and then transition the other way. Because if we just think about it from an evolutionary longitudinal perspective, of course that's what needed to happen for us to adapt and survive. Because one day you have to sprint to catch this, one day you have to go on the long hunt. And obviously we went on the long hunt a lot more. That's why we lost all this hair. But the ability to do those things really, you know, if you just think about it in Mother Nature's laws, it makes perfect sense. And that's always kind of my theme, is like, we are only trying to discover what Mother Nature's laws are. We're not making anything up. It's just little legitimate discovery. Like, we discovered Mount Everest, but it was there all along. We discovered the Hawaiian Islands, but they were there all along. Same thing here when it comes to physiology and training. We're just trying to discover what's actually going on, and then work in harmony and synergy with Mother Nature rather than in friction and try to like overcome her, which never works out.
Yeah, you know, it's a good point. It's like, we're on this path of discovery and exploring and all that stuff, and all you can do is kind of keep exploring. So what I'd love to do, so we've kind of danced around it, is we've talked about classification. So if we put race, let's just break it down very simply. If we put race pace in the middle, right, that's the specific. And then the way I like to think of it, again, largely borrowed from Canova and others, is anything as we get more and more slower, we go from like directly supporting that endurance side to like just to more general supporting that endurance side. And what I mean by so if we think of specific, we'll use the 5K in this example. If specific is 5K pace, and we say, okay, we're going to branch out a little bit and we're going to work on the kind of slower endurance side. Well, if we go, you know, just a little bit slower, let's say to 8K, 10K pace, what we're now doing is that's like directly supporting the specific work on the endurance side, right? Because it's just a little bit slower. It's still really connected to 5K pace. So it supports it directly. Then if we go a little bit out and we go, okay, from 10K pace to maybe like half marathon or 15K pace, somewhere in that. Well, now we're not directly supporting. It's more like indirectly, but we're still pretty close. So we'll still call it like aerobic support. But then if we go out a little bit further, so from lactate threshold, half marathon, let's say to kind of marathon pace or steady. Well, now we're more like, you know, we're pretty far away from 5K pace. Like, it's still supporting, but it's very much more general. It's very much of like, okay, we're just kind of developing our endurance. Generally, there's no direct tie to 5K pace. There's an indirect tie through these other paces. So it still matters, but it's very much general. And then if we go further out and we go from whatever steady to easy running or jogging, then we just say, well, you know, in Canova's terms, he'd call that recovery. Mm-hmm. Because it's so far removed that yes, it has a point. Yes, we need it, but it's at the very beginning of this long winding, you know, pipe to get to the end. So it has an important point. It sets kind of a foundation, but there's no direct tie to the specific work.
Mm-hmm. And then. Yeah. I like it. I like thinking of it as a fan, right? And you talked about one side of the fan, and now you're going to go into the other side of the fan of this kind of concept of direct, indirect support in general and recovery.
Exactly. Now we look at it on the other side. We say, okay, 5K pace. Well, anything faster follows that same pattern, right? If we're looking at 5K pace, well, we go a little faster. Well, what does that mean? Direct speed would be like 3K pace, right? Because it's very connected. It's a little bit different, but it's like directly supporting on that speed side. We go a little bit, you know, faster down to 1500 pace. Well, that's kind of that, again, that opposite of the aerobic support. It's the anaerobic support. It's saying, hey, we're not directly connected to 5K pace, but we're still pretty close in the ballpark, so this sets the foundation. We go a little faster, like we get to more general. It's maybe that 800 pace. It's like, well, you know, it's not really close to 5K pace, but it's you know, it still serves some purpose. And then we go a little faster, and it's like, well, we get to just pure speed, right? Where we're just doing 100 meter sprints or 60 meter sprints. Well, that is a kind of akin to, you know, easy running in a lot of ways. Is it's not directly tied to 5K pace, but it serves as this very general, you know, neuromuscular stimulus where it's like, okay, this sets the foundation. It, like, we need to connect it through some other work to get it to impact, you know, directly our 5K pace. But it does, you know, play this role. And I think when we look at things from kind of the specific out, fanning out, then we can look at it from that endurance side, that speed side, and more importantly, understand, you know, how the paces in between are supporting each other to ultimately support that specific race pace and develop that and develop the workouts to get there. And let me give one more example before I turn this over that I think really helps clarify this. So if I'll use a different example is if, you know, for that 5K, if I decide for this athlete, you know what, we need to do 4x mile at 5 minute pace with 2 minutes rest. And if we can do that, like that's going to be our big specific workout to get them better. Well, if I have that athlete line up and they can't do 4x mile at 5 minute pace, but instead can do it at 5:10 pace, I don't just keep hammering, oh, we're going to do 4x mile until you get down to 5 minute pace. Because that kink in the pipe could be, well, maybe they're only running 5:10 pace because, like, the gap between their kind of speed and that 5:10 pace, maybe they can only run a 3K at, I don't know, 4:55 or 5 minute pace. So they don't have that gap. So you have to say, oh, the kink in the pipe is I need to be able to do 800s at 2:26, pulling that number out of the air, 2:26 to be able to handle, you know, 4x mile at 5 minute pace. Or maybe on the opposite side is that athlete can't do 4x mile at 5 minute pace because he goes 5 minutes, 5:02, 5:06, and then like 5:15, and he falls apart because he can't recover in those 2 minutes. And you say, oh, that's because he doesn't have this aerobic ability. So I need to go one pace up or maybe two paces up and build this aerobic side so that when it comes back to that specific workout, okay, now I have the aerobic abilities to recover, to handle that pace without, you know, lactate going up and me falling apart at the end. And that's what I mean by these are all interconnected, is we can go up and down the kind of classification system and see how that each workout impacts our ability eventually to get to that specific workout and then ultimately that specific pace and race that we're trying to run.
Yeah, I'm going to quote another book, The Science of Winning by Young Olbrich, published in 2000. And he is kind of one of the godfathers of translating lactate dynamics to application in endurance world and swimming. I know it's heavily influenced Steve and me, and a lot of other coaches, and people use it to this day because it's still, you know, relative and also accurate data. And in it, Jan says, not only in the world of swimming, but also in many other sports, the hypothesis has for quite some time been put forth that training at the maximum lactate steady state is the magic and optimal method to improve an athlete's endurance, aerobic capacity, and power. Jan then says, however, nothing is further from the truth. The components that make up an athlete's endurance are very complex, and it's a fantasy to think that just one single intensity is capable of developing all the different components that are necessary for its improvement. Thus, the aerobic metabolic performance of an athlete has to be built up by a means of different types of exercises and at different swimming speeds, Continuous swimming is one of those types of exercises that could be used to build up an athlete's endurance. So when you really start looking closely at what people are saying, you start to see exactly this. He's saying, and it's kind of like, I feel like it's fashion all of a sudden, right? History, 20 years later, 23 years later, now everyone's like, oh my gosh, threshold, double threshold workouts. That's the key. And they're like, we already told, 20 years ago, we already realized this isn't the thing. Steve, science right. There is no magic pace or intensity. I mean, it's anyone trying to sell you on that, obviously, you know, has either, you know, is naive and or has other, you know, impulses at their demise. The reality is this, it's true. It's, you have to figure out what Steve calls the kink in the pipe, or what I call the biggest limiting factor, or LIMFAC. What's the biggest limiting factor? Lydiard, his assumption was everyone's power maxima or speed reserve was good enough. It's good enough. So he's like, our base sucks. And what he meant by that is the fraction at which one can sustain their maximum speed reserve or max velocity, or what I call power maxima, was too low. So that fraction was too low on race day. So they need to like make that fraction higher. So like, let's just say random numbers here. Peter Snell only could maintain for 800 meters 50% of his, you know, max speed, max velocity. So later it's like, well, I won't need to make that 50. If I can make that 50%, 80%, this guy's going to be pretty good, right? Because you get in the tireless state. And so that's what a lot of this sub-T, steady state, you know, threshold focus running is aimed at. But as Steve said in his example, right, you get to the track and you want to do these mile repeats at, you know, this pace and the athlete just can't hit it. It's probably because those mile repeats are at too high of a fraction of their power maxima or max velocity for them to sustain. So you might say, well, this kid has no foot speed, but we're going to do these repeats at five flat or 450 pace, but their mile PB is 440. How? It's impossible. To do that session, you then have to now raise the power maxima. And so, you know, you see this like examples of people who have not raised their power maxima, but who have raised their base. So I think of it as this base in the ceiling, right? Your power maxima or your max velocity relative to your competitive distance, that sets the ceiling, right? Versus the, you know, fraction at which you can work of that is your aerobic base and or foundation. And rather than thinking of it like a house, I tend to like think of it like an elevator. You can just press the button and they'll both go up if you do the right type of specific work geared towards that. And they will co-support each other and create this cohabitation that makes it like, whoa, that person's really rock and roll. Because how great would that be to have a higher power maxima or max velocity or speed reserve, and then also work at a higher percentage of that for a longer duration for your race pace? Pretty cool. Really good examples of people who have working at a really high fraction of their ceiling, a very high fraction of their ceiling, are Paul Radcliffe and Kipchoge, right? Both of those, they haven't gone faster in the 3K, the 5K, or the 10K. In the later twilights of their careers, as they've set the world records in the marathons, Paula back in the day, Kipchoge now. But for Kipchoge or Paula, even 0.2% fractal increase in efficiency towards their power maximum ceiling is another world record. So why would they spend time seeking to get faster absolutely with the power maxima when they can just get a small, small percentage and make hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars in that improvement. Now, someone who is a good example, a contemporary example, who might be like who should have probably gone the other way to increase their speed or go back to increasing their speed, you know, is one of our favorite people around here, Galen Rupp. If you look at Galen, when he was actually, from just a pure results standpoint, a really good marathoner, that was coming right off the heels of very, very fast 5Ks and 10Ks, right off the heels, right? And so it's like you had blue water because the ceiling was so high. But he's gone and focused solely on the marathon, had a lot of hiccups in training, injuries, inconsistencies. And so that power maxima has clearly declined. And with that, so has his marathoning ability, right? And it's a complex thing. And I just use it as an example, but you have to know as a coach, when is it time to basically, elevate the base and build the base, so to speak, or when is it time to raise the ceiling? And a lot of my training is anchored in raising the ceiling, because I realized for me, for a lot of athletes, their maximum velocity capacity is not quite as near as where it could be, because in this day and age, we are facing different things than, say, Lillard was back in his day and age, right? Back then, everyone was out. Kids were, moving around, moving and grooving, like, all the time on the farm. Like, it wasn't this really, sedentary lifestyle. Versus now, people don't have the pure physical literacy on how to run fast and the coordination and the mechanics, and because we live a much more sedentary lifestyle. So we have to, as coaches of younger people, work on that as well as raise the aerobic base and build the aerobic engine. So it goes to show you it's twofold, and that's why you need to understand the whole spectrum and understand what kind of supporting work needs to be done to build up the race performance. And for an athlete, it also might change at different times in their career. Sometimes it might be the speed support side that needs to be built up, but sometimes it might also be the endurance support side that needs to be built up.
Exactly. And this is why, like, simple periodization models work, general periodization models work, but sometimes you need to pivot and do something completely different based on that limiting factor or kink in the pipe. So, for example, I've done this before for some athletes, especially marathon athletes, is sometimes you start with the really fast stuff because you've been neglecting it for so long that you need a phase of training where you're doing that kind of pure speed, general speed, speed support, just building, 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 building. Because once they get into the marathon kind of more specific work, what happens is, like, you're not going to improve that kind of speed side stuff. And sometimes what can happen is the gap between, what feels comfortably fast and your marathon pace is so small that you have very little room for error. So you have to expand that gap before you train the specific stuff. And as you said, that can shift and change, the limiting factor can shift and change over time. So I use this example all the time, but I remember, one season Brian Barraza focused on, like, the mile and 800. And we've talked about this on previous podcasts. Why? Because when he came in as a freshman, I stuck him in the 800 and he ran flat out like 155 high. Oof. And I was like, oh gosh, like, we got to get faster if you want to do anything here. Like, I know your strength is going to be your aerobic system, but, like, at the same side, like, you've got to be able to run something decently fast if you want to perform to the level that you want to perform at. So sometimes you have to go in the opposite direction to kind of take care of that kink so that later on, like, over the long haul, it doesn't become this limiting factor. You're almost like predicting things to a degree. And I think this is what you see really good coaches do, is they're very predictive. And the other thing that I'd say as well is, the example I gave, I was having a conversation not too long ago with a college team sport coach who essentially, said, more people need to, more like football, basketball, whatever, team sport athletes in college, they need to run track in high school. And the reason is pretty simple, is just like you said, well, that foundation of mechanically, neuromuscularly running fast isn't always there because we specialize in football, basketball, whatever our sport is, so early we don't develop it. And that so many athletes are like, oh, I'm just going to specialize in football, for example, in high school and not run track and do the football offseason. And what happens in football offseason? Well, you do the things that are specific to football, which are often like, I'm going to get bigger and quote unquote stronger. But this college, you know, coach was telling me, like, the simplest thing you can do is add strength.
Yeah, you know, not hard.
Not hard. Like, it's what every college football program, strength and conditioning program, is essentially centered around, designed strength. But what is really difficult is laying that foundation of how to run fast and neuromuscularly being able to recruit muscles and produce force. And if you do that in high school, you lay that foundation so that that kink in the pipe, that limiting factor, isn't there, and you can layer on the strength that on top of that, and your performance is going to be much greater than if you try and get really strong and then in college you're like, oh crap, I need to run faster because that sets things apart. Well, now I'm much bigger, which is harder biomechanically to layer on the mechanics and neuromuscular requirements on top to get faster, and you're stuck. And I think the same thing applies in different degrees, you know, to us. And I'd say on the opposite end as well is, you know, a lot of times we talk about laying that speed foundation, but you have to lay in high school the foundation to be able to support the work mechanically, damage wise, muscularly, you know, mm-hmm. bone health wise. Mm-hmm. In order to support the work that we know you need to do in college and beyond, which is regardless of your training philosophy, if you're running a 5K, 10K, whatever, you're going to have to accumulate a decent amount of volume at some point. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't set the structure up, which both includes strength, but also includes, like, you know, some amount of running and conditioning and mechanics work, then you're going to kind of be screwed.
Yeah, you see, this is very common. It's a overly simplistic concept of these biomotor qualities, because strength is also specific. It has a coordination capacity. So I get stronger and build the quote unquote body armor by doing bench presses and build that body armor, which there's validity to that. But if I don't translate that improved myofibril density in those tissues that, you know, were worked in the bench press by creating plasticity, which is innervation. So that innervation of the tissues from the, you know, the motor axons and everything has to happen. Otherwise, you won't have the coordinative capacity to now apply that strength specifically. And that's where a lot of people miss the translation, I think. And for me, it was very gray and confusing for a long time as well. But when we look at, you know, again, just going back to this plasticity point, for kids, right? Kids are a lot more plastic than adults, but we're all plastic until the day we die, which is, it has to be that way from an evolutionary and epigenetic standpoint. But my wife, she did a lot of gymnastics, running, horseback riding in her youth, no eye-hand coordination ball sports. I had a more diverse sampling and did a lot more of that. Even to this day, like, if, you know, I throw keys at her, or say, hey, catch, it's just like her the organization, her brain's like, whoa, 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 it's like a threat, right? It's slower versus if you just like say, hey, heads up, and like I'll like see something coming and immediately just put my hand up to catch the thing if I deem I could catch it, like keys or, you know, some small projectile like a, you know, baseball or what have you, right? But that was, you know, that kind of quote, what we call now reflexes, right? It's, oh, it was, I got this training and it's reflexive. That type of innervation stays in the body and the tissues for a long time. I'll give a case in point here recently with Daniel Herrera, right? So he recently was like, he retired professionally and he went to, you know, graduate school, and he's been in graduate school for a year. He's been skateboarding 13 months, not training at all. I told him when he retired, because he had, you know, worked for, trained for about six, seven years. I go, you have about 3 years window that you would come back and still run fast, just FYI. If you ever want to just hobby, have fun, do this, like just from a speed, you know, innervation, reflexive standpoint, you have about 3 years, because like for 6, 7 years, we just worked on speed, strength, power, all this stuff. That was a cornerstone of his training, drilled into him. then, you know, this year finally settled down, second year of grad school. He's like, yeah, hey, I want to come back, but I want to do the 800 because I just want to have fun with it. And I don't want to have to do like all the, you know, general endurance work that also goes with like training for the mile 3K, because that's what he was primarily focused on when he was competing the first go around. So I said, cool, no sweat. Here, it's really simple. You just got to do this type of neuromuscular work, this type of general speed, and this type of anaerobic support. And we're just going to do that over and over and over again on 3 day, what I call 3 day rollovers, which was doctored from Dan Path's concept. And it's the same 3 days, you know, day one, day two, day three. It's the same exact training, same exact exercises, same exact volume, same exact everything. And I go, you just need to go through about 6 to 7, maybe 10 at best of these, and then you'll be good to go. So our anchor test, like the starting test time trial, was a 800 in late October, early November, early October, mid-October, in Boston, Massachusetts. You ran 154 high, 154.9 or something. 7 weeks later, he runs at BU Indoor, you know, and again, he wasn't trained for the eight, and he's only doing this, like, again, maybe 4 to 5 days a week running, time off, because, you know, papers and things and stress, and again, highly competitive graduate school programs, so it's not optimal, definitely suboptimal, quote unquote, training. Runs 148.6 or something, like 0.7 seconds off the Mexican national indoor record. Big jump, 154 high to 148 high, 7 weeks. Why? Because we just focused on what was specific and also developmental. Now, we haven't actually touched any power work. It was all capacity work. And so when we talk about capacity work with neuromuscular, general speed, or anaerobic support, capacity means you are doing the thing at a very high speed or faster than race pace, and you're taking as long a rest you need to maintain the quality every rep. We don't care about the rest interval. When we start to shift to power, that's when we look to do extension. And extension is either we can extend the duration that we're running at the speed for a rep, and or we can also shorten the recovery, and or we can make the recovery activity challenging, more challenging, like kind of, you know, the flux training concept, right? So that's really promising, because it's like, cool, you ran 148 off of just capacity work without working any kind of that power or extension work. So it's what I consider actually general or, you know, specific preparatory type work. Now the next transition is to go to, okay, can we now work on specific development and more of the competitive exercise? So that would be longer reps or reps at race pace or faster with very, very razor thin recovery. So a little different. We'll see where that leads, right? But that's an initial, and BU 800 that I ran, 148, was solely a test. It was like, hey, just go out and compete. Let's see when you hit the wall. You know, I just want the feedback because they give you the splits every 200, right? Let's just see what happens. Pretty darn impressive how even, so to speak, and the rate of deceleration that was not manifested in the 800 was for him. So now it's like a question of, all right, does he need to get absolutely faster? And the answer is no, right? Because he's running, you know, drop in 10 meter drop in fly hundreds, and he's getting, you know, with regularity, 11 lows, 10 highs, right? Regularly 10 highs. Like he's like 10.9, 10.8, 10.9, 10.8, 11.1, 11 flat, 11.2. Great. I think you're fast enough. Yeah, I think the power maxima is good enough, because 44, last time I checked, 44, 43 for a mirror speed, that's pretty solid, right? For an 800. So we can now go in the direction of now working what would be considered, quote unquote, the endurance side, and not endurance by running more miles, but endurance by making that recovery interval or relief interval between the bouts at race pace or slightly faster race pace way shorter. So that's the next step in the direction. When we understand how to go from general to specific like this, it does make training a little bit more predictive. It does make training a little bit more, as Canova says, mathematical. And just a side note, you know, there's, you know, oftentimes I'll, you know, coyly tweet on Twitter like, hey, easy runs don't count. And what I mean by that is I'm taking the position that the easy run is the recovery run. And the purpose of the recovery run is the most general thing you can do. And it primarily facilitates a couple things, right? One, it helps to be a tonic, aerobically kind of flush out metabolites out of the tissues and into, you know, sweat or respiration or the urine. And then two, most importantly, a lot of people forget, and this is why people overrun the recovery runs, is the glycogen replenishment activity. You should be taking a lot of carbohydrate before, and that increase in that heart rate, slight, very slight, like 120 beats, not that high at all, but that helps foster better glycogen synthesis in the skeletal muscles as well as the liver. And so if you go into a recovery run or easy run, but then you run too hard and you breathe kind of heavy and get that kind of like the anaerobic breath, where it's like, that means you're using glycogen. So the entire purpose of the easy run or recovery run, which is to build back up glycogen stores and get that super compensatory effect, you've now negated by running too fast for your recovery run. So that's why I try to say it's not training, because if you think of it as training, you'll try to press it. You'll try to push it. You'll try to supplement your endurance, type specific work with a little bit extra, because, oh, if I just run this, my recovery run just a little faster, I'll probably, actually, the reality is you're not getting the replenishment benefits you want. And it is hampering the training versus augmenting it.
Exactly. No, I think you get a lot of backlash on the recovery, and the point isn't that it's useless or what have you, but the point is it's very general.
Yeah, don't count it as training. Like, just put it in a separate bucket. Like, it's like, if you do that, like, it just makes it a lot easier, because now you know exactly why you're doing the activity.
Yeah, it's a different way to look at it in class.
Different accounting. Yes.
Yes. Different accounting. All right. So, anyways, we've gone down this rabbit hole of classification systems.
Woo! We nerd out. That was fun.
And all I would say is this, and we can, you know, go on and on about this, but if you haven't, like, go reread those sections in The Science of Running. And maybe what we'll do is, in the clubhouse, is kind of dissect this and add in some
bonds. I think we just need to make a channel where it's like, we are just dissecting Science of Running, like Science of Running dissect channel. Cause like,
I like it.
That'd be fun.
I like it. So we could, if you want to nerd out on us, guess what? We just came up on the fly. We got a new channel in our clubhouse chat, which is just going to nerd out on the science of running. So here we go. It's time to
sign up. Sign up. So here, I'm going to tell you guys, sign up right now. I'd sign up for the year. Lock it in, because we are unfortunately being hit by inflation left and right. And we're going to have to raise the monthly membership. So lock in the year. It is going to be, you know, pennies on the dollar. But yes, yeah, if you haven't signed up, sign up. Do it. It's the place to be.
There you go. You heard it here first. So take a look at it. Sign in. Lock in the year, because the prices are going up. We are making adjustments as we head into the new year, because inflation is real. So, you know, get on board while you still can. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks for all the feedback. We appreciate it. And best of luck coaching, running, and everything you're pursuing out there.